The taste of my own blood had become familiar over the past weeks. I bit the inside of my cheek again as another hunger pang twisted my gut, a self-inflicted distraction from the greater pain. 23 days since my last proper meal. Almost 4 weeks since Harker Vaug had discovered my plans to take control of our Orlok operation and had me beaten, stripped of gang markings, and cast into the depths with nothing but the clothes on my back. I, Corvus Brell, once respected lieutenant of the Ferris Fang, now reduced to this, a shadow creeping through the lowest reaches of Hive Primus, places I'd only heard of in warnings from the older gangers. The weight of the rusted auto pistol pressed against my thigh, a small comfort despite its near emptiness. 4 rounds remained. I'd counted them probably more than 10 times today alone. The shiv tucked in my boot was cut from a broken gate near a collapsed tunnel. It had already claimed 3 lives. Not gang rivals or enforcers, but other wretches like myself, fighting over scraps that even the most desperate would once have ignored. The underhive closed around me like a diseased throat. I'd never ventured this deep before, where even the hardened gangs rarely tread. Down here, the hive's infrastructure had been forgotten centuries ago. Pipes leaked substances that had no name, pooling into caustic puddles that ate through boot leather in hours. I learned to recognize the particular hiss they made when disturbed, like the death rattle of something large and venomous. Overhead, chemical rain dripped through the countless layers of the hive's superstructure. It fell in irregular patterns, each droplet carrying the toxic runoff from thousands of manufactorums above. A drop had caught my shoulder 2 days earlier, burning through fabric and raising a weeping blister the size of a bolt shell. The wound now oozed a yellowish fluid that smelled of copper and rot. The darkness was near absolute, broken only by sporadic lumens that had somehow maintained power for what must have been centuries without maintenance. They flickered with a sickly green glow that cast everything in a pallor that made even my own hands look diseased. The shadows they created seemed to move with purpose, hiding threats both real and imagined. Worst was the fog, a thick ammonia-laden miasma that clung to the ground in some areas, rising no higher than my knees, while in others it swirled up to obscure everything more than an arm's length away. Each breath burned my lungs and left me coughing up phlegm streaked with black particulates. The veterans in my former gang called it hive rot and claimed it would solidify a man's lungs into ceramic if he breathed it long enough. I dismissed such tales once. Now I felt the truth of them with each labored breath. My footsteps echoed on the corroded metal grating that served as flooring in the section. The sound bounced off walls slick with condensation and biological growth that defied classification. Not moss, not fungus, but something uniquely adapted to this toxic environment. I kept my hand on the auto pistol, finger resting alongside the trigger guard. Noise meant death down here, but silence was impossible on these walkways. The hunger had become a physical entity inside me, a parasite demanding satisfaction. I'd eaten the last of my boot leather 2 days ago, soaked in condensation to make it chewable. Before that, it had been a nest of blind, hairless creatures I'd found writhing in a puddle of lukewarm effluent. They had tasted of chemicals and desperation. A skittering sound ahead froze me mid-step. I dropped to a crouch, ignoring the protest from my wasted muscles. The green-tinged darkness shifted, revealing movement, not the purposeful motion of a ganger or even the lumbering progress of a scavenger, but the frantic darting of something small and numerous. Sump rats, a nest of them, at least a dozen from what I could make out, feeding on something in the shadows. My mouth watered involuntarily. Sump rats carried diseases, their meat tough and foul, but properly cooked over a chemical fire, they would provide protein, calories, life. I began to move forward, placing each foot with deliberate care, the shiv now in my hand. The attack came from my left, a rush of movement and the stench of unwashed bodies. I pivoted, bringing the blade up in a defensive arc that caught my attacker across the forearm. A shriek, high-pitched and animalistic, echoed through the chamber. Not a ganger, not even a proper scavenger, something worse. They were underhivers in the truest sense, feral humans who had never known the upper levels. 3 of them with skin so pale it appeared translucent in the sickly light, revealing a network of blackened veins beneath. Their eyes were huge, adapted to the perpetual darkness, and they wore patchwork garments fashioned from scavenged materials, plastic, rubber tubing, what might have once been a tech priest's robes. They moved with the jerky coordination of carrion insects, circling me as the sump rats scattered into the darkness. One brandished a weapon made from a length of pipe with jagged metal shards protruding from its end. Another carried what looked like a rusted surgical saw. The third, the one I'd cut, clutched its bleeding arm but held a crude net woven from wire and cable. I knew what they wanted. Not just the rats, but me, fresh meat in a place where protein of any kind meant survival. The hunger in their eyes mirrored my own, but with an additional gleam of feral cunning that had been honed through generations in this toxic hell. The first attacked with its pipe mace, swinging in a wide arc that would have crushed my skull had it connected. I ducked beneath the blow, driving my shiv upward into the soft underside of its jaw. Hot blood gushed over my hand as the creature convulsed, its massive eyes rolling back to expose yellowed sclera. I tore the blade free and spun toward the one with the saw. It moved faster than I anticipated, the jagged implement opening a long gash across my chest before I could fully turn. Pain flared, bright and immediate, but the wound was shallow, more blood than damage. I brought the auto pistol up, hesitated for a fraction of a second as I weighed the value of the ammunition against my life, then squeezed the trigger. The report was deafening in the enclosed space, the muzzle flash momentarily painting the chamber in harsh light and sharp shadows. The round took the creature in the center of its chest, throwing it backward into a tangle of pipes. Steam erupted where its body struck a junction, and its flesh began to blister and melt as it thrashed in the superheated vapor. The third, sensing its disadvantage, fled into the darkness, leaving behind its crude net and a trail of blood droplets from its wounded arm. I stood panting, the stench of cordite mixing with the ever-present chemical miasma, my ears ringing from the gunshot. Three rounds left, the sump rats were long gone, but as my breathing slowed, I noticed something unusual about the area where they had been feeding. They hadn't been consuming refuse or the corpse of some unfortunate scavenger. They had been gnawing at the edge of a plasteel container partially buried beneath debris. I approached cautiously, using the shiv to clear away the accumulated filth. The container bore the faded insignia of a merchant guild, not the symbol of House Orlok or any other gang. This was a cargo container, the kind used to transport goods from the upper levels. Its presence here in the deepest reaches of the Underhive made little sense unless a collapsed caravan. Merchant guilds occasionally sent expeditions into the Underhive, seeking exotic materials or lost technology that could be sold at premium prices above. Most never returned. This container must have been part of such an expedition, one that met with disaster. The seal had been partially compromised, likely from the impact of whatever catastrophe had brought it here, allowing the sump rats access. But the bulk of the container remained intact. I worked the emergency release with trembling hands, the mechanism protesting after decades of corrosion. When it finally gave way with a hiss of escaping preservative gas, I nearly wept. Inside lay rows of vacuum-sealed packages, each bearing the designation Emergency Protein Supplement and the skull and cog symbol of Mechanicus approval. Food, real, preserved food untouched by the toxic environment, enough to survive for weeks, perhaps months if rationed carefully. I tore into the first package with my teeth, too desperate to consider restraint. The contents had the consistency of paste and a flavor so bland it was almost non-existent, but it was the most exquisite thing I had tasted in memory. I shoveled it into my mouth with dirty fingers, feeling strength returning with each swallow. Only after consuming nearly half the package did my frenzied eating slow enough for me to notice a peculiarity in the texture. Something firm had caught between my teeth. I worked it free with my tongue and spat it into my palm. The dim green light revealed a small, pale object with a distinctive shape, a fingernail still attached to the upper portion of a human digit. My stomach heaved violently. I retched, body attempting to expel what I'd just consumed, but hunger kept most of it down. As I gasped and spat, the reality of my discovery became clear. This was no official Mechanicus ration. The container markings were counterfeit. This was the product of an illegal corpse starch operation, one of the many rumors that circulated in the upper hive, human remains processed into protein paste for consumption during famines or siege warfare. I had just eaten human flesh, processed and packaged for efficient consumption. The thought should have horrified me more than it did. Instead, a cold calculation took hold. The protein was still protein. The calories would keep me alive. And in the Underhive, survival trumped all other concerns. I resealed the package and gathered as many as I could carry, securing them in a makeshift sling torn from the clothing of the feral I had stabbed. The weight of the containers was reassuring against my back as I moved away from the site, seeking a defensible position where I could rest and plan. The finger I left behind, a small marker of humanity discarded in a place where such concepts had long ago been abandoned. The Underhive had claimed another piece of me, not flesh this time, but something less tangible and more valuable. I felt the change settling into my bones like the toxic dust that coated everything down here. As I navigated the treacherous pathways, the green lumens casting my elongated shadow before me, I understood that I was becoming something new, not an Orlok ganger, not even a common Underhive scavenger. Something else, something born of ash and marrow, of hunger and survival at any cost. And deep in the toxic darkness, that transformation was the only currency that mattered. The blow came from behind, a dull impact at the base of my skull that sent me sprawling. My precious food containers scattered across the corroded decking as consciousness faded. My last thought before darkness claimed me was not of escape, but of the wasted calories now lost to the Underhive's perpetual hunger. I awoke to the sensation of movement, my body being dragged across uneven metal grating. The scrape of my heels against rusted edges sent jolts of pain up my legs, but I remained limp, feigning unconsciousness. Through slitted eyes, I observed my captors, four figures in patchwork armor made from flak vests, industrial padding, and what appeared to be medical braces. Each wore a respirator mask with tubes connecting to filtration packs on their backs. Not the feral Underhivers I'd encountered earlier, these were organized, equipped. The crude symbol painted on their armor pieces told me everything I needed to know. A human skull with the top removed, painted in white against a dark red background, the Bone Harvesters. I'd heard rumors of them even in the upper levels of the Hive, corpse traders who controlled several blocks of the Underhive, scavenging the dead for whatever could be salvaged. Some said they were chaos worshippers, others claimed they were simply businessmen with the most abundant resource in the Underhive as their stock in trade. My captors hauled me through a maze of corridors, each turn taking us deeper into territory I hadn't yet explored. The air grew thicker with industrial runoff, but unlike the toxic miasma of the outer Underhive, this had the distinct smell of chemical preservatives and disinfectants, artificial cleanliness amid the decay. We passed through a makeshift checkpoint where the corroded bulkhead had been reinforced with scavenged materials. Guards with auto pistols and shotguns stood watch, their eyes tracking our progress with the dispassionate gaze of career killers. One nodded to my captors, gesturing toward an opening in the far wall where the green-tinged darkness gave way to harsh white illumination. The processing facility had once been a promethium refinery, its massive industrial equipment repurposed for an entirely different kind of refinement. The ceiling soared three stories above, a rare open space in the cramped Underhive. Suspended from rusted chains, dozens of floodlights cast unforgiving illumination across the operation below. My captors dropped me unceremoniously onto a metal grate floor. The impact drove the breath from my lungs and sent fresh pain shooting through my already battered body. Through watering eyes, I took in the full scope of the Bone Harvester's operation. Bodies, dozens of them, hung from hooks along a conveyor system that wound through the chamber like a mechanical serpent. Some were fresh, with wounds still leaking fluid. Others showed signs of advanced decay, their flesh mottled with the distinctive patterns of toxic exposure common in the Underhive. Workers in stained coveralls moved among them with practiced efficiency, assessing each corpse before directing it to different processing stations. The smell hit me then, not the expected stench of rotting flesh, but the clinical odor of preservatives, sterilizing agents, and beneath it all, the unmistakable scent of cooking meat. My empty stomach clenched in hunger even as my mind recoiled. A figure approached, taller than the others by at least a head. As she drew closer, I realized it was a woman, broad-shouldered and muscular, with a shaved scalp covered in intricate scarification patterns. Each mark, I would later learn, represented a kill, creating a macabre tally across her pale skin. She wore no respirator, only a high-collared jacket of what appeared to be treated human leather, the surface oiled to a dull sheen. Vex Scoria, leader of the Bone Harvesters, looked down at me with eyes so dark they appeared as empty sockets in the harsh lighting. Her face bore the marks of countless Underhive battles, a missing ear, a nose that had been broken and reset multiple times, a web of scar tissue across her left cheek where some caustic substance had burned away the flesh. She crouched beside me, examining my face with the detached interest of a butcher assessing a cut of meat. Her fingers probed the muscle of my arms, checking the density of tissue beneath my skin. Seemingly satisfied, she stood and gestured to her subordinates. They hauled me to my feet and marched me deeper into the facility, past workers stripping corpses of anything valuable, augmetics, teeth, certain organs preserved in cloudy fluid-filled jars. I noticed the vacant expressions on the workers' faces, their movements mechanical and repetitive. Many bore the distinctive dilated pupils of obscura addicts, the drug numbing them to the horror of their tasks. We stopped at a processing station where the conveyor system split into multiple tracks. Here, bodies deemed suitable for consumption were separated from those too toxic or disease-ridden. The acceptable corpses continued along the main line toward a series of industrial machines that had been adapted from meat processing equipment. The rejected ones were diverted to a secondary line that disappeared into a wall opening, presumably leading to some other form of recycling. Vex Scoria circled me slowly, assessing my potential value. Her heavy boots echoed on the metal grating as she completed her inspection. She reached decisions quickly, issuing orders to her subordinates with hand gestures rather than words. The atmosphere in the facility made verbal communication difficult. The constant drone of machinery, the hiss of steam from pressure valves, the wet thud of meat being processed. My options were presented without ceremony. Join the bone harvesters as a finder, someone who locates fresh corpses in the underhive, or become product myself. The choice was no choice at all. I nodded my agreement, and Vex seemed satisfied, though no emotion crossed her scarified face. They took me to a side chamber where a man with augmetic eyes operated a tattoo needle connected to a humming power pack. The needle bit into the skin of my forearm, injecting black pigment in the pattern of the bone harvester's symbol. The pain was sharp but bearable compared to what I'd already endured. Only after the tattoo was complete did I notice the slight weight beneath the skin, a small lump no larger than a low stick filter. One of the harvesters saw my fingers probing the area and explained the implant's purpose. A small explosive charge that would detonate if I strayed beyond the territory controlled by the gang. The crude but effective method ensured loyalty through fear, a common currency in the underhive. They assigned me a bunk in a dormitory shared with other finders, a room that had once been a chemical storage chamber, now fitted with stacked sleeping platforms bolted to the walls. Each platform had a thin mat stained with the bodily fluids of previous occupants. The smell of unwashed bodies and fear permeated the space. My new colleagues were a diverse collection of underhive survivors. Some were former gangers like myself, cast out from their original groups. Others were native underhivers who had found the bone harvester's protection preferable to the constant threat of starvation. All shared the same hollow-eyed look of men and women who had abandoned whatever moral framework they once possessed. They issued me equipment, a sack for transporting corpses, a crude cutting tool for removing them from wreckage or tight spaces, and a canister of preservative spray to slow decomposition. Most valuable was the respirator, a salvaged Imperial Guard model with fresh filters, protection against the toxic environment that would extend my life expectancy considerably. The senior finder, a hunched man with radiation burns across half his face, explained the territories we were permitted to search and which gang boundaries to avoid. He detailed the payment system. Finders received protein cubes based on the quality and quantity of corpses they retrieved. The best specimens, those with minimal toxic contamination and all organs intact, earned the highest rewards. I memorized his instructions while studying the dormitory, noting potential weaknesses in security. The explosive in my arm complicated escape plans, but I'd survived this long through adaptability. There would be a way out, I simply needed to find it. That night, lying on my assigned bunk, I watched the other finders prepare for sleep. Many injected themselves with obscura or other narcotics, seeking temporary escape from our grim reality. Some mumbled prayers to the Emperor or darker entities. Others stared silently at the ceiling, their thoughts hidden behind vacant expressions. From my position, I could see through a ventilation grate into the main processing area. The night shift continued the endless work of the bone harvesters. Fresh corpses arrived on trolleys pushed by other finders returning from their expeditions. The bodies were cleaned, assessed, and processed through various machines that separated useful components. The final stage of processing caught my attention, Massive grinders reduced human flesh to a paste that was then mixed with binding agents and preservatives before being pressed into uniform cubes. These protein cubes were the bone harvester's primary product, sold to desperate hivers who asked no questions about their source. In the perpetual famine of the underhive, food was food, regardless of origin. I recognized the cubes immediately, identical to those I had discovered in the crashed merchant container. The realization sent a cold shiver through me. The bone harvesters weren't just opportunistic scavengers, they had a distribution network reaching the upper levels of the hive. Their operation was larger and more sophisticated than I had initially assumed. Morning came without sunlight, marked only by a shift change and the distribution of protein cubes to the finders. I ate mine without hesitation, the knowledge of its contents no longer shocking. Survival required pragmatism, and my body needed strength for what was to come. My first expedition as a finder took me back into the toxic corridors of the underhive, this time with better equipment and a specific purpose. I was paired with another finder, a woman named Lith, who had been with the harvesters for 3 years. Her face was permanently fixed in a grimace due to nerve damage from toxic exposure, giving her the appearance of constant displeasure. Lith showed me the most efficient hunting grounds, areas where violence or environmental hazards regularly produced fresh corpses. Gang territories were particularly fruitful after skirmishes, though they carried the risk of encountering hostile forces. Collapsed habitation sections often contained the bodies of those who had been trapped by structural failures. The areas surrounding toxic waste outlets claimed regular victims who miscalculated the lethality of the fumes. As we worked, I noted the routes we took, mentally mapping the bone harvester's territory and its boundaries. The explosive in my arm limited how far I could travel, but understanding the extent of those limitations was crucial to any escape plan. I needed to know the exact range of the detonator and whether there were methods to disable it. By the end of the day, we had collected 3 bodies, a gang member killed in a territorial dispute, an underhiver who had succumbed to a respiratory infection, and a child who had apparently starved to death. Lith handled each with the same detached efficiency, assessing their value as product rather than acknowledging the lives they had once contained. I followed her example, suppressing the revulsion that still occasionally surfaced. We returned to the processing facility with our harvest, joining the queue of finders waiting to have their collections evaluated. The assessors examined each corpse carefully, checking for signs of disease or contamination that might reduce their value. Our take was deemed acceptable, earning us each an extra protein cube for the day's work. That night, as I lay on my bunk planning my next move, I understood the true horror of the bone harvester's operation. It wasn't the processing of the dead that made them monsters. In the underhive, pragmatism often overrode traditional taboos. It was the cold economic calculation behind their enterprise, the reduction of human life to its component parts and market value. I had killed before as an Orlok ganger and as a desperate survivor, but always with immediate purpose. The bone harvesters had industrialized death, creating a system that profited from the underhive's endless supply of corpses. They weren't chaos worshippers or sadists. They were business people who had identified the most abundant resource in their environment and built an enterprise around harvesting it. As I drifted into uneasy sleep, the explosive under my skin a constant reminder of my captivity, I wondered which was truly more horrifying, the feral underhivers who killed out of hunger and instinct, or the bone harvesters who had built a commercial empire on the rendering of human flesh. Both were products of the underhive's brutal ecosystem, adaptations to an environment where survival was the only virtue that mattered. And I was becoming one of them step by calculated step. The alarm klaxons shattered my sleep on the 7th day of my captivity. Harsh red emergency lumens pulsed through the dormitory, casting bloody shadows across the startled faces of my fellow finders. The senior finder burst into the room, his radiation-scarred face twisted with urgency. Some Kraken Goliaths had breached the outer perimeter, a full-scale assault on bone harvester territory. We scrambled for weapons. My hands found a rusted autogun with a poorly repaired stock and a drum magazine that rattled with loose ammunition. The weight felt reassuring after days of carrying only cutting tools and corpse sacks. Around me, other finders armed themselves with whatever they could grab, shotguns, pipes studded with metal shards, salvaged chainswords with teeth missing from their belts. The irony wasn't lost on me. I was about to fight alongside my captors, defending the very operation that had enslaved me. But survival in the Underhive rarely accommodated moral consistency. The explosive implant beneath my tattoo ensured my cooperation, but something deeper drove me as well, the primitive instinct to defend territory, even territory that wasn't truly mine. The Sump Kraken Goliaths were notorious even by Underhive standards. Unlike the Bone Harvester's pragmatic approach to commerce, the Goliaths embraced a philosophy of physical dominance. They augmented their already massive frames with combat stims and crude muscle grafts, creating warriors that towered over normal humans. Their armor consisted of salvaged industrial plating bolted directly to flesh in some cases, their pain receptors dulled by constant chemical enhancement. They weren't attacking out of moral outrage over the Harvester's corpse trade. The Underhive had no room for such luxuries. They wanted control of the lucrative operation for themselves, viewing the Harvesters as competition in the business of survival. We took positions along the main approach corridors. The facility's architecture favored the defenders, narrow passageways with multiple choke points, areas where toxic runoff could be redirected to create impassable barriers, overhead gantries providing elevated firing positions. I found myself crouched behind a barricade of scrap metal, my auto gun braced against a support strut, watching the darkness beyond the facility's outer perimeter. Vex Scoria moved among us, assigning positions with hand gestures and cold efficiency. When she reached me, she paused, studying my face with those black, emotionless eyes. Recognition flickered in their depths, not of me as an individual, but as a resource with particular value. She gestured for me to follow. In a small side chamber filled with surveillance equipment, Vex showed me a crude map of the facility and surrounding territories. The attacking Goliaths were using tactics I recognized immediately, standard Orlok gang maneuvers. The realization struck me like a physical blow. The Goliaths had allied with my former gang, combining the Goliaths' brute strength with Orlok's strategic doctrine. Vex recognized my understanding. Her scarred face remained impassive as I indicated the likely points of concentrated attack, the feints designed to draw defenders away from the main thrust, the secondary teams that would target infrastructure rather than combatants. Years of Orlok training allowed me to predict their movements with reasonable accuracy. I marked entry points on the map where ambushes could be established, where the corridors created natural kill zones. The first wave hit exactly where I'd predicted. A diversionary force of stim-enhanced Goliaths charged the main entrance, absorbing fire while smaller teams attempted to breach secondary access points. The corridor outside the processing facility became a killing ground. La's fire and solid rounds cut through the confined space, ricocheting off metal walls. The Goliaths advanced behind makeshift shields fashioned from bulkhead plating, absorbing punishment that would have dropped normal humans. I held my position on an elevated gantry, picking targets with measured precision. The autogun bucked against my shoulder, its recoil familiar after years of similar weapons. Each shot found its mark, knees, throats, the exposed portions of Goliath anatomy not covered by their patchwork armor. The Harvesters around me fought with the desperation of those defending their livelihood. They lacked the Goliath's raw strength, but compensated with knowledge of the terrain and the advantage of prepared positions. Battle flowed through the facility's outer chambers like toxic sludge, filling every space with violence. The narrow corridors amplified the horror, nowhere to retreat, nowhere to avoid the press of bodies, the spray of blood, the deafening cacophony of gunfire and screams. The air grew thick with cordite and the copper tang of spilled blood. A secondary team of attackers breached a maintenance shaft I'd overlooked, smaller fighters, likely Orloks, who lacked the Goliath's bulk but moved with practiced coordination. They emerged behind our defensive line, cutting down three Harvesters before anyone registered their presence. I swung my autogun toward the new threat, dropping two with controlled bursts before my magazine clicked empty. No time to reload. I abandoned the gantry, dropping to the lower level and drawing my cutting tool, a curved blade designed for separating limbs from torsos during corpse collection. The Orlok fighter who rushed me wore the distinctive reinforced leather jacket of a scout. His face registered shock as he recognized me, his former lieutenant, now fighting alongside the Harvesters. That moment of hesitation cost him his life. My blade opened his throat with practiced efficiency, his blood adding to the slick coating on the metal grating underfoot. The battle pushed deeper into the facility as the Goliath's numbers began to tell. They breached the outer processing rooms, where corpses in various stages of dismemberment hung from hooks along mechanized tracks. The workers, mostly obscura addicts with little combat training, fled in panic or died where they stood, cut down by Goliath heavy stubbers. Vex Scoria rallied her forces at the entrance to the main processing chamber. The massive rendering vats inside represented the heart of the harvester's operation, enormous industrial cauldrons where human remains were reduced to their component nutrients. Steam hissed from pressure valves, creating a fog that limited visibility and turned the chamber into a nightmarish landscape of half-glimpsed horrors. I found myself fighting alongside Vex herself, our backs to the primary rendering control station. Her weapon of choice was a power maul, likely salvaged from an enforcer corpse that crackled with unstable energy. Each swing pulverized Goliath armor and the flesh beneath it, leaving broken bodies in her wake. I covered her flanks with my reloaded auto gun, picking off attackers that tried to circle behind her. The Goliaths breached the main chamber with overwhelming force. A massive warrior, his skull augmented with metal plates and his arms thick with crude muscle grafts, led the charge. He carried a weapon I recognized as a mining tool repurposed for war, a pneumatic hammer that could shatter rockcrete with each blow. Behind him came at least 15 fighters, some Goliath, some Orlok, all focused on taking the processing facility intact. What followed was butchery rather than combat. The Goliaths grabbed processing workers and threw them bodily into the rendering vats. The screams as they hit the superheated liquid inside echoed through the chamber, rising above the gunfire and clash of weapons. The remaining workers panicked, stampeding toward the emergency bulkhead doors at the far end of the chamber. The doors remained sealed, a standard security protocol during attacks, creating a bottleneck where dozens of bodies crushed against unyielding metal. I witnessed workers trampled underfoot, their bones snapping under the weight of the panicked crowd. Others were crushed against the doors themselves, their bodies compacted by the pressure of those behind them until ribcages collapsed and internal organs ruptured. The floor grew slick with blood and bodily fluids, making footing treacherous for defenders and attackers alike. Vex Scoria fought like a creature possessed, her power maul leaving a trail of destruction through the Goliath ranks. I stayed close, conserving ammunition and taking only the shots I knew would count. We were forced back step by step, retreating deeper into the facility as the Goliath secured the main processing chamber. The fighting drove us into a secondary corridor I hadn't explored during my brief time with the harvesters. The passage sloped downward, leading to a lower level that didn't appear on the facility maps I'd seen. Vex sealed a bulkhead behind us, buying precious minutes as the Goliaths worked to breach it. Five other harvesters had made it out with us, all wounded to varying degrees. One clutched a gut wound that spilled loops of intestine between his fingers. Another had lost an eye to shrapnel, the socket a ruined mess of tissue and bone fragments. The lower level opened into a chamber that froze my blood despite the facility's oppressive heat. Row upon row of cage-like enclosures filled the space, each containing huddled human forms, not corpses awaiting processing, living people. Men, women, and children stared out with hollow eyes and gaunt faces. Some reached through the bars with skeletal hands, making no sound but conveying desperate pleas nonetheless. Others lay motionless on the bare metal floors of their cages, too weak from starvation or illness to acknowledge our arrival. Most disturbing were the markings on the cages, colored symbols indicating processing priority and notations about physical condition. These weren't random captives. They were livestock, kept in reserve for when the supply of fresh corpses couldn't meet demand. The children came primarily from the Sump Sea settlements, where poverty and toxic exposure created vulnerable populations easy to prey upon. Adults bore the marks of various underhive factions, gang tattoos, worker guild brands, even the distinctive scarification of other scavenger groups. The bone harvesters weren't just collecting the dead. They were creating new corpses when necessary, maintaining a living inventory to ensure production never slowed. The horror of it struck me more deeply than the battle we'd just escaped. I'd known they were monsters of necessity, but this revealed a calculated cruelty beyond mere survival. Vex noticed my reaction. For the first time, emotion crossed her scarified face, not shame or remorse, but something closer to annoyance at having this aspect of the operation exposed. She approached me with measured steps, her power maul still humming with energy. I tensed, expecting execution for having seen too much. Instead, she deactivated them all and reached for my arm, the one bearing the explosive tattoo. With a small tool extracted from her belt, she made a precise incision beneath the skin and removed the explosive device, a gesture that shocked me more than anything I'd witnessed in the facility. The removal wasn't mercy or trust, it was pragmatic recognition of value. My knowledge of Orlok tactics had proven useful. I was now an asset worth cultivating rather than controlling through crude coercion. The bulkhead behind us groaned as the Goliaths began cutting through with industrial tools. We had minutes at most. Vex led us deeper into the chamber, past the rows of caged captives, toward an emergency exit that connected to maintenance tunnels running beneath the main facility. The wounded harvester with the gut wound collapsed before reaching the exit. No one stopped to help him. Resources were allocated based on survival potential, and his was clearly insufficient. As we entered the maintenance tunnel, the sounds of battle grew distant. The narrow passage forced us to move in single file, crawling in sections where collapsed infrastructure reduced clearance to less than 2 feet. The air grew progressively more toxic as we moved away from the facility's filtered environment. Our respirators, standard equipment for finders, kept us alive, but the captives being evacuated from the holding area wouldn't last long without similar protection. The knowledge of what I'd discovered weighed on me as we navigated the labyrinthine tunnels. The bone harvesters had crossed a line that even the Underhive's moral flexibility couldn't accommodate. They weren't just processing the already dead, they were farming the living. The distinction mattered, even in this hell where survival justified almost anything. As we emerged into a secondary harvester outpost several sectors removed from the main facility, I began calculating my next move. The explosive was gone from my arm. The Goliaths now controlled the main processing center. The harvesters were vulnerable, their operation disrupted. If there was ever a time to escape this new captivity, it was now. But freedom in the Underhive was relative. Without faction protection, lone survivors rarely lasted long. The Goliaths would kill me as a harvester. My former Orlok gang had already tried to execute me once. Independent scavengers faced constant threats from every direction. The harvesters, for all their horror, offered structure and resources in a place where both were precious commodities. Vex Scoria watched me with those black, calculating eyes as similar thoughts clearly ran through her mind. She had removed my explosive leash, but that didn't mean I was free. The Underhive itself was the true prison, and she knew it as well as I did. The question wasn't whether I would run, but whether running offered better odds than staying. The holding pens full of living captives changed the calculation. I could justify processing the already dead as grim necessity. I could not reconcile myself to hunting the living, especially children. The line between pragmatism and monstrosity had been crossed, and I could not uncross it in my mind. Vex seemed to read these thoughts on my face. Her hand moved to the power maul at her belt, fingers tightening around its grip as she assessed the threat I now represented. The other surviving harvesters tensed, watching the silent confrontation between us. The decision point had arrived sooner than I'd anticipated, forced by circumstance rather than careful planning. I made my decision in that moment of tension with Vex Scoria. Her hand remained on the power maul, eyes calculating my worth against the risk I posed. I lunged not at her, but toward the control panel governing the holding pens. The other harvesters reacted too slowly, expecting me to attack their leader rather than the infrastructure. My fist connected with the emergency release, an old Imperial design with a physical override that couldn't be countermanded once activated. Alarms blared as cage doors throughout the holding area slid open with hydraulic hisses. The captives hesitated, disbelieving their sudden freedom after weeks or months of confinement. Vex's power maul hummed to life as she swung at my exposed back. I rolled beneath the arc of crackling energy, feeling the displaced air tingle across my skin. The maul connected with the control panel instead, sending sparks cascading across the chamber and plunging sections into darkness. Chaos erupted as freed captives poured from their cages. Most were weak from malnutrition and abuse, but desperation lent them strength. They overwhelmed two harvesters through sheer numbers, tearing at respirators and protective gear with bony fingers. The harvesters' screams cut short as toxic air filled their lungs, tissue dissolving from the inside out. I seized a respirator from a fallen harvester and thrust it toward the nearest group of escapees, gesturing for them to share it as they fled. The Underhive would claim many of them, but some might survive with proper guidance. I had memorized enough of the tunnel network to lead them toward a rumored settlement run by House Cawdor, religious zealots, but ones who might offer sanctuary out of twisted devotion to the Emperor. Vex recovered quickly from her missed strike, but the tide of escaping captives separated us. She barked orders to her remaining fighters, prioritizing recapture of their living stock over pursuing me. The confusion gave me the opening I needed to slip into a maintenance shaft adjacent to the holding area, a narrow tube barely wide enough for my shoulders. The shaft carried me downward through layers of corroded infrastructure. Decades of leaked chemicals had eaten through sections of the metal, forcing me to navigate carefully to avoid plunging through weakened areas. The sounds of pursuit faded behind me, replaced by the omnipresent dripping of toxic condensation and the distant rumble of ancient machinery still functioning without human oversight. I emerged into a transit tunnel that had collapsed long ago, its original purpose lost to time. The ceiling had partially caved in, creating a landscape of broken rockcrete and twisted support beams. The air here was thick with particulates that swirled in the beam of my salvaged lumen. My respirator filter would need replacement soon. The indicator strip had already turned from green to amber, warning of diminishing effectiveness. Behind me, I heard the sounds of others navigating the maintenance shaft, not harvesters in pursuit, but escapees following my path. They emerged one by one, blinking in the dim light, their bodies showing the effects of long captivity. Skin hung loose on frames that had once been muscular. Eyes had sunk into hollow sockets. Many bore the marks of hasty surgeries where organs or tissue samples had been harvested while keeping the stock alive. I recognized a boy of perhaps 12 years, his left arm ending in a recently healed stump where a hand should have been. His eyes held none of the vacant terror of the others. Instead, they burned with a cold fury that seemed out of place in one so young. He had survived the holding pens not through luck, but through calculated endurance, conserving energy and avoiding attention. A born underhiver, adapting to each fresh horror with grim determination. 23 escapees gathered in the transit tunnel, sharing the handful of respirators we had managed to seize during the chaos. I explained the route toward the Cawdor settlement through improvised sign language and crude maps scratched into the dust. The toxic atmosphere made extended speech dangerous even with respirator protection, forcing communication to its bare essentials. We moved as a ragged column through the labyrinthine underhive, each step taking us further from the harvester's outpost. The journey would normally have taken hours for experienced hivers, but our group's weakened condition stretched it into an ordeal that lasted nearly a full day cycle. We navigated by maintenance markings left by long-dead repair crews, faded imperial symbols that still offered guidance through the decaying infrastructure. The route took us through sections where the environment itself was the primary threat. Pools of liquefied waste material blocked passages, forcing detours through unstable areas. Pockets of gas with no color or smell killed one escapee who strayed too close, his body convulsing before collapsing into stillness. Colonies of underhive fungi spread across entire chambers, their spores causing hallucinations and disorientation in those without proper filtration. We lost 7 more escapees to the environment before reaching the outer territories controlled by House Cawdor. Their boundary markers were unmistakable human skulls mounted on metal spikes, each forehead bearing the flame symbol of their zealous faith. Candles burned in the eye sockets, specially formulated wax that resisted the toxic atmosphere. The wavering flames created the illusion that the skulls were alive and watching our approach. The Cawdor settlement appeared more fortress than habitat, its walls constructed from the wreckage of collapsed hive sections. Figures moved along the ramparts, their silhouettes distorted by elaborate headdresses and the heavy robes that characterized Cawdor aesthetics. They carried a mixture of autoguns and crude flamers, weapons that reflected their obsession with purifying flame. We never reached their gates. The attack came from a side passage I had dismissed as too narrow for human transit. Armored figures emerged in disciplined formation, their movements betraying professional training rather than gang tactics. I recognized the distinctive black carapace armor and skull-faced helmets immediately, enforcers, specifically a skull squad, the specialized pacification units deployed when Lord Helmaor decided a section of Underhive required cleansing rather than policing. They moved with mechanical precision, encircling our group before most realized what was happening. Unlike the gangs who fought for territory or resources, enforcers killed with bureaucratic efficiency. Each shot was placed center mass, conserving ammunition and maximizing lethality. Five escapees died in the first volley, their bodies crumpling without even the dignity of final resistance. The boy with the missing hand reacted faster than the others, dragging two younger children behind a fallen support beam. I followed his example, pulling as many as I could reach into whatever cover the transit tunnel offered. The enforcers advanced methodically, their helmets equipped with vision enhancement that negated the advantage of shadows. The squad leader stepped forward, his armor bearing additional insignia that marked him as a veteran of multiple pacification operations. He addressed our cowering group not with threats or demands, but with a procedural statement delivered in the flat tone of someone reading from an internal protocol document. The enforcers had been monitoring the bone harvester's operation for years, he explained. Their corpse trade served as an effective population control measure in sectors deemed non-viable for rehabilitation. The recent disruption, first by Goliath's, then by my actions, had destabilized the careful balance maintained in this region of the Underhive. My blood ran cold as the implications became clear. The enforcers hadn't come to rescue captives or shut down an illegal operation. They had come to eliminate witnesses to their sanctioned neglect. The Imperium had determined that certain Underhive sectors were more useful as self-regulating waste management systems than as potential sources of recruits or labor. The gangs, the scavengers, the corpse traders, all were permitted to exist because they reduced the population without requiring resources from above. The enforcers opened fire again, their las weapons cutting through our meager cover. The escapees had no weapons to return fire, no armor to absorb the deadly energy. They died where they huddled, bodies illuminated by the red flashes of las bolts. I used my autogun to provide covering fire, more to buy time than with any hope of defeating a Skull squad. The weapon's report echoed through the transit tunnel, drowning out the screams of the dying. The boy with the missing hand appeared at my side, his face set in grim determination. He pointed toward a maintenance hatch partially hidden behind accumulated debris, an access point to the water purification system that served this section of the hive. It offered our only chance of escape from the enforcer's methodical advance. I provided covering fire while the remaining escapees, now reduced to 8 terrified survivors, crawled toward the hatch. The enforcer squad split their attention, some continuing their advance while others targeted the exposed hatch area. 3 more escapees fell before reaching the relative safety of the access point. The boy worked the manual override with his remaining hand, forcing the rusted mechanism to yield through sheer determination. The hatch finally opened with a shriek of protesting metal, revealing a vertical shaft with maintenance rungs embedded in the wall. The survivors disappeared into the darkness one by one, the boy holding position until the last had entered. I expended my remaining ammunition to buy those precious seconds, each round finding an enforcer but doing little against their carapace armor. The boy and I entered the shaft together, pulling the hatch closed behind us. Ancient locking mechanisms engaged automatically, temporarily sealing the enforcers out. They would breach it eventually, but the delay might give us enough distance to escape. We descended the maintenance rungs into absolute darkness, guided only by the feel of metal beneath our hands and feet. The shaft opened into a vast chamber that hummed with the operation of ancient machinery. Emergency lumens activated at our movement, revealing a water purification facility that had continued functioning without human oversight for centuries. Massive filtration tanks lined the walls, processing the toxic runoff from upper levels into water clean enough for industrial use, if not consumption. The survivors gathered near the main control console, their faces showing the first glimmer of hope since captivity. The facility appeared defensible, with only the shaft entrance and a sealed bulkhead providing access. The machinery provided background noise that would mask our movements from pursuit. Most importantly, the control room contained a cache of emergency supplies, preserved rations, medical kits, even replacement respirator filters. I examined the ration packages with initial suspicion, half expecting to find the same corpse starch produced by the bone harvesters. Instead, they bore the legitimate stamp of Imperial manufacture, likely stored here when the facility was still regularly maintained. The supplies would sustain our small group for months if properly rationed. The boy explored the control systems with intuitive understanding, activating dormant systems, and restoring functionality to sections of the facility that had been offline for generations. His single hand moved across the controls with surprising dexterity, navigating machine interfaces designed for long-dead operators. A display screen flickered to life, showing schematics of the surrounding infrastructure and the purification cycles currently in progress. That was when I noticed the discrepancy. The chamber wasn't a water purification unit as I had initially assumed. The schematics revealed it to be a waste processing facility designed to break down and recycle organic and inorganic materials flushed from upper hive levels. The filtration tanks contain not water but liquefied waste in various stages of decomposition. The machinery hummed not with purification processes, but with grinding mechanisms temporarily paused between cycles. Boy recognized the truth at the same moment, his face draining of what little color remained. The control display showed the current status, processing cycle paused, resumption scheduled in 20 minutes. The chamber we had believed to be sanctuary was actually the interior of an enormous recycling mechanism, temporarily dormant but soon to resume its programmed function. The enforcer squad chose that moment to breach the shaft entrance, their armored forms descending with practiced coordination. Simultaneously, the sealed bulkhead began to cycle open, automated systems preparing for the next stage of waste processing. We were trapped between advancing enforcers and machinery designed to reduce everything within the chamber to component materials. The survivors looked to me with desperate hope, seeking guidance I couldn't provide. The rations that had seemed like salvation now represented only a cruel extension of suffering, enough food to survive while we exhausted every escape option, only to face the same inevitable end. The enforcers advanced methodically, spreading out to cover the chamber with overlapping fields of fire. I weighed our options with the cold calculation the underhive had taught me. The maintenance shaft was now blocked by enforcers. The processing machinery would activate in minutes, grinding anything in the chamber into recyclable components. The opening bulkhead led deeper into the waste system, areas where even respirators would provide only minutes of protection against the most caustic environments in the hive. The boy made the decision before I could, grabbing an emergency flare from the supply cache and igniting it. The brilliant chemical light momentarily blinded the advancing enforcers, their vision enhancement systems overloading from the sudden intensity. He gestured toward the opening bulkhead, his intent clear, better to die fighting for escape than to surrender to either the enforcer's execution or the machinery's indifferent consumption. The remaining survivors rallied around his desperate courage, arming themselves with maintenance tools, emergency equipment, anything that could serve as a weapon. I found myself at their center, the autogun empty but still useful as a bludgeoning instrument. We charged toward the bulkhead opening, using the enforcer's temporary disorientation to gain precious seconds. The squad recovered quickly, La's fire cutting through our group with lethal precision. Two survivors fell immediately, their bodies tumbling to the metal grating. Another took a glancing hit that seared away half his face, yet he continued forward, driven by the underhive's most fundamental imperative, survive no matter the cost or pain. We reached the bulkhead as the processing machinery roared to life behind us. The grinding sound of metal teeth engaging filled the chamber, drowning out even the report of enforcer weapons. The floor began to tilt, automated systems preparing to funnel all contents toward the processing mechanisms. The enforcers, recognizing the danger, broke off their advance and retreated toward the maintenance shaft, prioritizing their own survival over completing the elimination operation. Beyond the bulkhead lay a nightmare landscape of interconnected waste channels, each carrying different categories of hive refuse towards central processing nodes. The caustic atmosphere immediately began degrading our respirator filters, warning indicators shifting from amber to red within seconds of exposure. We had minutes at most before the environment would kill us as effectively as any enforcer. The boy pointed toward a maintenance crawlway visible through the toxic haze, a service access that might lead to adjacent systems with less immediately lethal atmospheres. We moved as a group, each step bringing fresh pain as exposed skin contacted surfaces contaminated with industrial runoff. Behind us, the processing chamber completed its cycle initiation, the bulkhead sealing automatically to contain the operation. The crawlway narrowed to a passage barely large enough for a child, forcing adults to proceed on hands and knees. The metal surfaces were slick with condensation that bore the distinctive iridescent sheen of promethium contamination. One survivor slipped, his hand plunging through a corroded section into a flow of waste material beneath. He pulled back a limb stripped to bone, flesh dissolved in seconds by the concentrated toxins. His screams echoed through the confined space until his respirator filter failed completely, toxic atmosphere replacing oxygen in his lungs. Our numbers continued to dwindle as we navigated the waste system. Respirator failures claimed two more. Another disappeared when a section of crawlway collapsed beneath him, dropping his body into machinery below. By the time we reached a junction that offered multiple paths, only the boy, myself, and one other survivor remained, a woman whose Cawdor tattoos suggested she had been captured during a religious pilgrimage through Underhive territories. The junction presented three options: continuing through the waste system, ascending toward what appeared to be maintenance levels, or descending deeper into the Hive's infrastructure. The decision carried the weight of life and death, yet had to be made in seconds as our respirators approached complete failure. The Cawdor woman pointed upward, her faith directing her toward the symbolic ascension. The boy gestured toward the deeper path, Underhiver instinct suggesting safety lay further from the levels controlled by gangs and enforcers. I chose the maintenance level, reasoning that such areas might contain emergency equipment or access to less toxic environments. We separated without ceremony, each following the path deemed most likely to yield survival. The Underhive recognized no bonds of loyalty beyond immediate mutual benefit. When that benefit ended, so did cooperation, a harsh truth, but one that had ensured my survival thus far. The maintenance shaft narrowed as I climbed, the rungs slippery with the same toxic condensation that permeated all Underhive infrastructure. My respirator filter had minutes of effectiveness remaining, its indicator now flashing red in urgent warning. Each breath came harder than the last as the filter approached saturation. The shaft seemed endless, ascending through layers of Hive structure with no indication of its destination. When I finally reached a platform, my arms trembling from exertion and my lungs burning despite the respirator, I found myself facing a sealed pressure door bearing the skull symbol of enforcer authority. The maintenance level connected directly to an enforcer outpost, likely the base from which the skull squad had been deployed. I had climbed directly into the heart of enemy territory. The absurdity of my situation struck me with sudden clarity. I had survived gang warfare, toxic environments, the Bone Harvester's operation, only to end here, trapped between advancing machinery below and enforcers above. My respirator filter failing and no path forward that didn't lead to certain death. The Underhive had played its final cruel joke, offering the illusion of escape while closing every actual avenue of survival. My respirator filter failed with a faint click that seemed impossibly loud in the confined space. The toxic atmosphere burned my throat with the first unfiltered breath, tissue damage spreading with each subsequent inhalation. Through watering eyes, I studied the pressure door, noting the access panel that would alert the enforcers to my presence if activated. Beyond that door lay clean air, medical treatment, perhaps even survival, if I surrendered to Imperial authority and accepted whatever fate they deemed appropriate for one who had witnessed their sanctioned neglect. The alternative was to descend back into the waste system, following the boy's path deeper into the Hive's forgotten infrastructure. Down there, death would come more slowly but with equal certainty, as toxins accumulated in my system and resources dwindled to nothing. There was no victory to be found, only different forms of defeat. I made my choice in that moment of clarity, understanding finally that the Underhive offered no true escapes, only different forms of death. I activated the access panel, the alarm immediately sounding throughout the enforcer outpost. Through the small armored viewport, I saw figures responding to the breach alert, moving with the same mechanical precision that had characterized the Skull Squad's attack. As the pressure door cycled open and enforcer weapons trained on my position, I reflected on the fundamental truth of Underhive existence. The hunger never ends, not the physical hunger that had driven me to consume human flesh processed into anonymous protein, not the hunger for power that motivated the gangs and corpse traders. not even the hunger for order that drove the enforcers to sanitize inconvenient truths with laws, fire, and execution orders. The Underhive was hunger incarnate, an ecosystem built on consumption, where everything was eventually devoured, whether by industrial machinery, toxic environments, predatory gangs, or the Imperium's calculated neglect. We were all just different forms of waste being processed through the system, temporarily useful before being recycled into the Hive's endless cycle of predation and consumption. As enforcer hands seized me and chemical restraints bound my wrists, I understood that my journey through the Underhive had transformed me in ways that could never be undone. I had become part of its metabolism, another organism adapted to its toxic reality. Whether I survived the next hours or not, the Underhive had claimed me as surely as it claimed all who ventured into its depths. The hunger would continue long after I was gone, consuming countless others in its endless, implacable cycle. In Necromunda's Underhive, that was the only certainty that remained.